The following is a conversation with Vitaly Katsenelson, a chartered financial analyst and the author of The Little Book of Sideways Markets and his newest book, Soul in the Game. In this episode, we discuss how much money you need in order to live a good life, how much money you should expect to have when raising a family and children, how to make decisions and control your emotions, and Vitaly weighs in on an ongoing debate on this show, which is whether or not hedge fund billionaire Ray Dalio is accurate in his prediction that the Chinese Empire will surpass the United States as the world's next great superpower. You write about money and about living the good life. I wonder, how much should we focus on money in trying to pursue a good life?
If you think about money, okay, it's something that's necessary. It's kind of like air to some degree. However, having a lot of money is not going to make you happy. Having too little money could make you unhappy. Okay, so having too much money may not bring you happiness. Having too little money could bring unhappiness. So I think pursuit of money in itself is not worth pursuing. What we should be really looking for is trying to figure out how if you use money as a game. And I like Warren Buffett enjoys investing, not because he's trying to make another billion, but for him it's a game. That, investing is a game. And when casino, you get chips, and investing is a game, money is a chip. Money is just a unit of count. But that's not why Warren Buffett gets up in the morning. But at the same time, you also don't really need, you really don't need that much money, meaning that if you lead a mindful life and you're mindful how you spend money, then you won't need that much money. You won't need as much money as society thinks you should have. My publisher came to me and said, Vishnu, you should write a book about Stoic philosophers and wealth. I said, that's going to be the shortest book ever written, because this is just going to say, just be happy with, just enjoy what you have. And that's kind of, or value what you have. So that's kind of my answer to this.
Mm-hmm. So if there is a sort of a minimum threshold, you said if we don't have enough, then we could be unhappy because of that. What would that threshold be like, or how could we determine what that threshold is?
Well, obviously it's a different for everybody, where they live, et cetera. There's a hierarchy, of needs. Okay, so shelter, shelter is number one. I don't remember all of those things, but you have shelter, food, and then after this, probably you want to be able to go to the doctor. But after this, things get discretionary very, very quickly. Do you need to have a $100,000 car, or you can drive, $30,000 car for 15 years? I mean, that's a choice you can make. Do you need to go to, you can figure out what kind of vacations you take, etc. So what's important about this, you want to be mindful about how you spend your money. In other words, if your only goal is to have a lot of money, and you make a lot of money, you can still not have enough for two reasons. Number one, because you could spend it more. And number two, because the reason you want to make a lot of money because you want to have more than somebody else, there is always somebody else who's going to have more money. So number one thing I would do to make sure that when you are figuring out how much money you need, it's a relative to what your needs are, not based on what how much money your friends make. Okay, that's number one. And number two, just be mindful about spending it.
Something I've had come up in a lot of conversations with a lot of my peers, folks in their 20s, 30s, is that they assume that with marriage and family life and children, that they won't have enough money. As people approach those steps in life, what could they be doing to figure out how much money they really need to tackle that next phase of life?
When my wife and I got married, actually, I'll tell you the story before this. My wife and I were married maybe for a little bit less than a year, and she tells me that she's pregnant with my niece, that she's pregnant, and I had this kind of I was sitting in the armchair, and I sat in this armchair for 3 hours without speaking a word. Okay, and kind of my mind as a calculator was running, these regressions of how we're gonna pay for this child. And then I called my father, and I said, she's pregnant. He said, like, congratulations. Yeah, but I said, how are we gonna pay for this kid? And he said, listen, there's 7 billion people in the world. Somehow they figured it out, and so will you. So I think so that was very liberating. But when my wife and I got married, my friend Mark and I took us out to lunch, and he basically gave me this little lecture. And I have to preface this. At this point in time, I had a master's degree in finance. I was a CFA. I was working for an investment firm. So I knew, so Mark tells me, Vitaly and Rita, what you guys have to do, you need to create a budget. And he said, and then you put your expense, you have your income, you have your expenses, and what's left is the money you can spend. I was kind of like, I was a little bit offended because I have a master's degree in finance. But then Mark went a little bit further and he said, now, what's important to understand that the expenses you're thinking about, those are not enough, because the expenses that come to mind to you would be your rent, your cable bill, etc. But what happens, there are some other expenses that may not happen in every month, but they are happen on a semi-regular basis. You buy a car every so many years, okay? Your goal is to make sure you don't get in debt. So when you buy your next car, you don't borrow money to buy that car, but what you do, but you actually save the money for that. So therefore, if you're gonna buy a car every so many years, and you figured out that then you make sure that you put a few $100 a month, whatever that is, that when you're 5 years, you need to buy a new car, you have the money. If you and I had this conversation a year ago, you would have said, but look at the cost of how cheap credit is, and it was. Today, if you're going to buy a new car, suddenly you're going to be paying 7 or 8% interest. So by borrowing money, actually you actually increase the cost of that car substantially. And the more money you use to borrow, the more expensive things become. So that's very important. But anyway, so car is one example, but you're also going to have vacations. If you didn't save money for vacations, you suddenly have to put them on credit card and have to pay 20% interest rate. So if you put a few $100, well, whatever that number is, you figure out how much you need on vacations. If that becomes a line item in your budget, then when vacation comes, it's you're prepared. All you're trying to do is kind of try to create the sinking funds for future expenses. And if you do that, then you're most likely going to be living within your means. Okay? That's point number one. Point number two, and you and I already talked about mindfulness, and this is very important. Money buys the most when it buys things you value. If you spend $3,000 a year going to Chipotle, and $3,000 a year going to Starbucks, this is kind of, but you receive absolutely no pleasure going to Starbucks, but you love every single bite of this Chipotle burrito, I would argue that $3,000 more, spending Chipotle, is more meaningful to you. Now, once you realize that, you realize, well, maybe I can save $3,000 a year on Starbucks and use that money to, eat two burritos a day if you wanted to, or it buys you another vacation. So what happens if you start being mindful about your budget, then you start realizing to get something, you need to give something up. To get something you value, figure out what you value less. Like when my kids were young, we used to go on vacations to Mexico. And then I realized, my God, we live in Colorado and we should be skiing. So we stopped going to Mexico and we started skiing because we could not do both. So money does not have to be cause of frustration. It just, you know, you just have to be mindful about it. You have to plan it. And I'll tell you, when my wife and I got married, we did not buy new furniture. Okay, you know, our family gave us, you know, furniture, etc. But we would go on vacations, because vacations were more meaningful to us than having new furniture. We were saving money for new TV, and at the time, TVs cost more than $1,000. And then Luciano Pavarotti came to town, and we used that money we were saving for the TV to go to Luciano Pavarotti's concert. So we had to give something up to do that. And I'll be honest, we as a society put more value on material things. And I don't know how many TVs I had over the last 20 years, and none of them are memorable to me. And none of them really, they all kind of did the same thing more or less. But that memory of going to Luciano Pavarotti concert is so tangible to me. And today, when I still bring it to my, you know, when my wife and I talk about this, it still brings a smile on our faces. And
you call this a sinking fund. And in your book, yeah. I believe you said that's yeah. short for sort of a synchronization. What are you synchronizing? Are you synchronizing your present self with your future self, yourself with your wife? What is synchronizing?
Well, that's a great point. So you're synchronizing many different things. Mm-hmm. Number one, you get married. You and your spouse may have different wants. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be very stereotypical. Girls like clothes, boys like, I don't know what boys like. Okay, so now my wife and I just, you know, actually sit down and we say, okay, listen, we don't want to argue about this. Let's figure out what's the right amount, we should spend on clothes, how much money I should be spending on my electronics or whatever. Or going out. And once we decided this, then then it wasn't me telling my wife, you're spending too much money. She knows how much money she said she was going to spend and how much she was spending. So it's a stop being a point of friction, because we both agree on that amount. Mm-hmm. That's point number one. So you're sinking your, the first thinking you're doing is you're synchronizing your spending to what you can afford. Mm-hmm. But the second thinking you're doing is thinking future into the present, mm-hmm. From future to present. What do I mean by that? Like the car we talked about, mm-hmm. that's a future mm-hmm. expense, okay? But which occurs as a lump sum. So therefore, you need to be funding it, that expense today, if you don't want to be borrowing, you know, a large chunk of money and paying interest on that. Mm-hmm. I really like Stoic's approach to this. It's like happiness comes from wanting what you have, mm-hmm. and we as a society decided that we need to have the latest and greatest things. But what you find that material things actually don't bring us, you know, after a certain point, after you have a roof over your house and it's warm, etc., material things don't really give us that much joy, because what they do, they give us this jolt, and then and it's very temporary, and then it goes away. So that's what synchronization is, kind of thinking the future to present. Mm-hmm.
And for you as a parent, how do you think about this in terms of how you deal with your children? I've read some of your essays and stories about how you could bribe your son with $50 or things like that. Is there a point where maybe having money and resources is actually difficult, because maybe it's harder to say no? Or are there other things that you think about as a parent with money?
So I think, number one, I think each child requires a different approach. Mm. And I'm saying this based on my kids. Mm-hmm. Different approach, a different state of their lives. You know, so my son Jonah was bribable with money and things all his life. My daughter Hannah, until she started going out, did not care about money at all. So she, you know, so she was not really bribable with money. But she was a bribe. You know, she was she. I could bribe her with my time. I would say, if you do this, we'll go to Barnes and Noble, and I'll buy you a book, and we'll spend some time together. So it's, oh, we'll just spend some time together. So the one thing I learned about kids and money, you always want to give them less than they think they need. You always want to create constraints. Because when you create constraints, then they have to make choices. Just like you and I were talking about making choices between Starbucks and Chipotle, they have to start making these choices early in their life. Are they going to be going out to Chipotle 3 times a week, or are they going to be going to a more expensive restaurant once a week? So when my son, after high school, he had a gap year and he lived in Israel. And he basically, imagine, he lived with 3 roommates. Everything was paid for but food. And I was giving him, I forget the amount, but let's say maybe $100-something a week, which was basically barely enough. And this was expensive, you know, just to buy food. So he had to figure out how to be creative and buy, you know, how to be creative. And he, when he looks back at his time, it, you know, at, there were times when he had to buy, you know, canned beans, etc. But he looks at this time and he doesn't look as a time of misery, not at all. He was very proud of that time because he had to become entrepreneurial. He had to figure out how to live within, you know, within that budget.
Yeah, the power of constraints and enforcing creativity in so many domains. I mean, perhaps that's something you see in your writing or that we see in other creative endeavors, but it can be a surprisingly positive force.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And speaking of constraints in childhood, how do you feel that you learned to manage constraints, particularly with your upbringing outside of the U.S. and then coming to the U.S. as a young man?
Yeah. So the in other words for constraint is scarcity. Mm-hmm. So I grew up in Russia. So throughout my in the Soviet, not just in Russia, in Soviet Russia, where scarcity was kind of an everyday event. My parents, you know, stood in line to buy chicken, eggs, bread. I think I had one pair of jeans. Actually, maybe probably a pair of pants, you know, and I had one sweater. And you know what?
You were in a cold part of Russia, right? I mean, yeah, especially cold. Part,
yeah. And, you know, it was good sweater. Okay. You know, it wasn't a fancy sweater, but it was, you know, kept me warm. Mm-hmm. But the in our society we look at scarcity from a negative perspective, mm-hmm. and especially and I can see that especially if you look at my childhood, the only thing I experienced was scarcity. Now, there's my favorite story about this is the when I had Pepsi for the first time, because I really, like in Soviet Russia, they didn't have Pepsi or Coke. And I remember like when I was 16 years old, I was somewhere where it was very hot and I had a glass of Pepsi. It was the most incredible magic experience in my life. It was absolutely incredible. Now, when we came to the United States, I discovered that I can buy Pepsi and Coke in gallons. And it costs just a little bit more than water. And Brandon, over the next year, I consumed more Coke and Pepsi than I made up for the previous 17, 18 years of my life. Then a few years later, I'm in a restaurant ordering a third refill of Coke and I'm drinking it and I'm realizing I can't taste it because my taste buds have been completely desensitized to it. And this is when I realized that abundance is not necessarily a good thing either. So I actually had to create my own scarcity. I had to put my own constraints on myself. So I said, from now on, I'm only going to drink Coke or Pepsi when I go to the movie theater, which I go maybe a few times a year. And I tell you, and that was like almost 30 years ago. Yeah, close to, you know. And that's, and I've done it since. And I tell you, every single time I drink Coke, Pepsi today, I enjoy every single sip of it. Now, so there is a value. So the punchline here is this. Abundance is not necessarily a good thing either. Because what it does, it makes, we stop valuing what we have. So we should create, we live in a world of abundance. I'm not saying we should move in into apartments that are the size of a phone booth. But we should impose a certain amount of scarcity on life just to taste life better. Just like I put the scarcity to taste that Coke better.
In your book, you also write a lot about habits. What are other habits that maybe people can adopt that can make life have more taste?
Well, so this is, okay, I have to be careful about this conversation. Let me tell you why. Because I don't want to tell people what to do.
Mm.
Okay? I want to be tell, what I'm saying is what this is what I do.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I'm, this is what works for me. Now, when you listen to this, you may say this particular example does not apply to me, but I can modify it, mm-hmm. and that will apply to you. So I find that I write 2 hours a day. For me, it's very important. So I get up, I make a cup of coffee, I get my laptop, get my headphones, and for 2 hours, I listen to classical music and I write. To me, that is incredibly important. That's how I start my day. I also walk in the park every single day. And I find that to be very important. Not actually, it's for surprising reason, actually. Not because it makes me physically healthy. I mean, I'm sure there are benefits to that, but it's also, I think it's also, it's a, helps my creativity and it helps my mental, and it kind of clears my head. Because what happens, we spend most of our day sitting, observing symmetrical objects. If you look around your room, look at the screen you're looking at, every single object you have, you know, is symmetrical. Okay, when you go to the park, there's no symmetry, there's very little symmetry. And I think what it does, it creates new pathways of thinking. This is how you get new ideas. So this is some of the habits I have. I mean,
Now we've talked about the value of scarcity and things, and maybe the effect of money is bad, but everybody wants to be rich. So what are habits that you've seen in people who are very high net worth individuals that you think make people rich?
Well, number one, I just really want to stress this point. And I know, like, rich is a relative word.
Mm.
Okay. I know people who have hundreds of millions of dollars who think they're poor.
Mm.
And I know people who make $50,000 a year and they spend money in a way that makes them wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's a point number one. Point number two, I don't think I've seen anybody been successful without focus and without reading. I think focus, I mean, I think I heard the story of how Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, when asked, how can you, to what you contribute to your success, both independently said focus. And I can definitely see that. I think focus is very, very important. But I think also is also kind of being a kind of constant learner is very, very important. Mm-hmm. I mean, some people are rich because, they won a lottery, meaning they created, not in a literal sense, but they had an idea and it made them rich, okay? But if you look at something that's repeatable, it's people who became rich. It was focused.
Mm-hmm. How do you apply that now with your organization and your work? What do you pick to focus on now?
Well, this is a very good question. I am extremely protective of my time. If you tell me, so there's kind of three versions of ourselves, right? What you think you are, what other people think you are, and what you really are. If you want to find out what you really are, just look how you spend your time. Okay. So I wear different hats. I write articles. You know, I write. I run the IMA as the firm. I invest. And I also market the firm. Now, I made a decision that I want to spend very little time on marketing. I want to spend most of my time either basically doing research and a little bit of time running the firm, and 2 hours a day I want to spend on writing. So, the way my company works is that nobody here makes outbound calls looking for clients. People read my articles, they come to us, and they don't even talk to me, they talk to somebody else. So I do none of this. At times, I do podcasts like what we're doing right now. And though actually I'm not even promoting the firm, I'm really just want people to read the book. So this is, you know, this is what I'm promoting here. And then I have two offices here, actually. The office where I'm here right now, which has a computer with two screens. And then I have another room, what I call the cave, and it's basically a dark room. It has a very comfortable chair. It has a blanket. It has headphones. It has a large iPad. And that iPad does not have, it has internet, but it doesn't have email or Twitter or other communication or Slack. And so I spend 4 or 5 hours a day in this room, undisturbed. My phone is not there. And I'm just I'm reading, okay? Because that's, you know, this is how I want to spend my time. I want to be doing research, and I find that I'm the most productive when I'm not. I don't have willpower. I don't have much willpower. The way I create this willpower is by creating the environment when I don't have to use it. So that room is kind of, I call it cave because it's very cold there, that I like cold temperature. So, but that's how I apply it in my life.
So Vitaly, to get to your research, one thing that's come up a lot on this show is issues with Ray Dalio's opinions on China. And you've written a little bit in your book about Ray Dalio. I wonder what you would think about this. So Ray Dalio is a hedge fund billionaire, and he's been very outspoken that China's future is very bright, and he believes China could be the next great superpower. Whereas Peter Zion has come on the show, he said very much the opposite, that China is on the edge of a catastrophe. What have you found in your research about the future of China?
So I have a tremendous respect for Ray Dalio, but I think it's important to understand his bias. And he's kind of almost like a politician here. I get a feeling that he probably, you know, he manages hundreds of billion, you know, I don't know, hundred something billion dollars. Some of that money is probably for Chinese entities. So now, if you want to continue to manage this money, you can't really say anything that's critical of China. Now, and that's just, and that is the core of the problem. Let's say Ray Dalio was managing money for some kind of pension fund in France. He could be critical of French economy, and it will not make a difference. Okay. However, and this is the key issue, when it comes to Russia, when it comes to China, when it comes to North Korea and some other countries, you can't speak negatively about this country because there will be repercussions, because those are not democracies. And I think actually I agree in agreement with Peter Zion, because what China did to some degree is remarkable. They brought in like incredible number, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Now, they were able to do this because they didn't suffer the bugs of the feature of bug of a democracy. Okay, if you want to build a highway and there is a building on the way, if it was any democratic country, the property rights would, you know, the people would say, well, this is my building, you know, and you would have litigation, etc. So it may take you 15 years to build a highway. In China, that building would just be demolished because, right. And so the dictatorships kind of, or I'm not sure, but, you know, I guess the authoritarian systems, they're more, a lot more expedient. The problem is that, you know, so there is an upside to that. You can, so you can build cities in, you know, in a few years. Mm-hmm. That's the upside. The downside that comes at the expense of, you know, of personal freedom. Mm-hmm. That also comes at the expense that it creates excesses, because it's basically, if you look at what's happened in China, is that they set a goal that they want to grow economy at any cost. Why? Because they figured if they keep growing economy, people will be employed, they'll be happy, they have social stability. So they started to set goals to grow. What I learned is that the power of incentives. If you create a goal to grow, and the way they did this, they did kind of on the local municipality level. And, you know, if you are a little king in that municipality, you're told you need to grow 10% a year. So what's the easiest way to grow 10% a year is to build. So China built a lot of buildings. And like Egyptians built a whole bunch of pyramids. And I'm sure when they were building those pyramids, the economy was growing. But these pyramids, maybe 5,000 years later, they have a tourist value. But I'm sure for a long time there was just blocks of concrete or whatever, you know, with very little utility. So when you have what China did, they created a lot of empty cities. That nobody lived there. And the problem is, to build the cities, somebody had to give out loans to build them. So you had a lot of bad debt. So China right now has a huge bad debt issue. And also, you know, Peter Zeihan obviously talks about, you know, they have demographic issues, etc. So I mean, in the next 5 or 10 years, China may get stronger or may not. But longer term, I would not be better than China. Even as a global superpower, because they're going to have significant economic issues. Mm-hmm.
And you believe that those significant economic issues would be as a result of the bad debt, or do you see
other factors? Yeah, it's a result of misallocation of capital. Bad debt is exactly yes. Mm-hmm.
So how do you navigate around that, then, knowing that that you have this thesis that that's going to have a ripple effect as China is so integrated with the rest of the world?
Well, I think it's difficult. I mean, I would be very careful to my exposure to commodity stocks long term, especially, you know, not as much oil per se, but the industrial commodities. I would not want to own any companies that are based in China. I would want to limit the amount of exposure I have to companies that have a lot of sales coming from China. I think those would be kind of the ways to deal with that. Mm-hmm.
So for you as an investor, when you're making decisions about things like this, you're looking at so many factors. How do you keep your emotions in check and keep yourself rational about making big decisions with large sums of money in particular?
If you think about it, it's not much different if I was a blackjack player, a blackjack or poker player. You just try to be very process-based. you try to make sure that you make the best decisions possible, given information you have, knowing that you could be making right decisions in the short term. They don't get rewarded. But if you're a good poker player and if you're making decisions that maximize your odds, in the short term, you know, your decisions and outcome could be completely divorced. In the long term, you know, you'll be absolutely fine. So we are incredibly process-based here. So for every single company we buy, we do hundreds of hours of research. We look, you know, we build financial models, we talk to management, and once we determine it's a high quality business, then we figure out how much do we want to pay for, you know, how much it's worth, and then figure out how much discount to what it's worth, we want to pay for it, and just kind of do this one stock at a time, and knowing that I have a portfolio of stocks, and by the way, I've been doing it for almost 25 years. Don't remember a single period in time where every single position I had worked out. Yeah. It just doesn't work this way. But that's how I approach, you know, kind of, this is how I stay rational.
Mm-hmm. So sticking to a process-based approach has helped you to balance for your emotions.
Yes.
So in personal life, how does that play out? Do you have processes in personal life or habits, or how do you navigate your emotions in day-to-day life?
That's a good question. I'm not even sure I have a good answer for it. Do I have a process in my everyday life? Let me see. I like it. I think I've been very picky about people I spend my time with. So if a person is toxic, unless it's a, you know, a family member, and it's because at this point it's not a choice, I try to spend as little time with them as possible. If this is a person who has value system that I feel that I don't agree with, then I would, spend very little time with that person as well. So those are kind of like, that's only hack I can think of, where I can bring a process to things. So one thing I found, this is kind of interesting. So when the pandemic happened, I started to work from home for the first 3 months of the pandemic, 3-4 months of the pandemic. And I enjoyed it a lot because I now get to spend a lot more time with my family. But then what happened, that I found that I was kind of an emotional mess. And it took me a while to figure out why. But when you go to work, that creates kind of this kind of the pillars around your day. It's going to work is a habit in itself. Getting up in the morning,
yes,
writing, etc. You know, I'm going for work. When I stopped doing it, I didn't have a structure in my day, and losing the structure was actually just, you know, kind of, it's actually destabilized me mentally. Like, I was not as calm as I was before. I felt like uneasiness. So I found that having a structure in your day is very, very important. And this is kind of, I would argue, this is a downside of traveling a lot, because you kind of lose that structure. But I think if you approach it mindfully, even when you travel, you can still create some structure. Not 100%, but you can still wake up in the morning and go for a walk. You can still do push-ups, etc. So you can, there's still certain things you can do, but anyways, but having a structure in my day, I found to be extremely important.
Yeah, I would echo that too. I know that if I say go to stay with family or something like that, if I get up and I do the same couple of things that I normally do in the morning, you know, I go for a little walk and meditate a little bit, and just that seems to help me to carry my normal structure when I am in a different location.
Yeah. And actually, I remember we went to Mexico for vacation for 2 weeks. And the first 3 or 4 days, I was just had zero structure and I felt horrible. And then I started to get up. And what I found was very, very hot. So I couldn't really spend that much time outside during, like in the, during the day because it's very hot. So I started to get up at 4:30 in the morning and I would go for a walk on the golf course. And then I would go riding. So, and that actually, doing that actually kind of completely restored my kind of my mental sanity.
And Vitaly, speaking of your writing, before we get to my last question, for people who want to check out your writing, where should folks look for you online?
Yeah, so if go to investor.fm, and there you'll be able to subscribe to, kind of see my writings and subscribe to my articles. Yeah. And I have a podcast. You can subscribe if you go to investor.fm, you can subscribe to my podcast, but it's called Intellectual Investor Podcast. So if you just look on the favorite podcast app, you'll be able to find my podcast.
Great.
And it's a Brandon, unlike your podcast, my podcast is a lazy man's podcast. By the way, but actually that is a great example of how I manage my time. I don't have the time to do podcast. And I, to be honest, I don't even, and I don't, you know, like what do what you do requires a lot of preparation, a lot of energy. I enjoy being a guest in a podcast, but I'm not sure but I never wanted to commit the time to do what you do. So what I did, we created a podcast where somebody else, not me, reads my articles to you. And that's my podcast. And people love it because what we discovered that some people have time to read. Some people are readers, some people are listeners, and some people are both, but they have more time when they're working out, to listen, etc. So that's what my podcast is. It's just my articles read to you, not by me, and you should be thankful for that, but by a professional narrator.
Great. Well, we will put links to that in the description for folks to check out. And my final question is, you've written this book about living a good life, but you are still a middle-aged man. What do you look for in the next chapter of your life? What will you be reflecting on, writing about in the future?
I just, you know what it is? I just keep going through life and keep learning new things and keep writing. Since the book came out, I think I already wrote 6 or 7 new chapters, and I probably wrote another 50 articles on non the kind of on investing, economy, different things, life as well. So I just keep learning new things and I keep writing. So my it's kind of interesting. I find that I, as you get older, I well okay now okay let's start from this. I think happiness in life comes from having good problems. If your life is full of good problems, that's how I get meaning. That's how I get meaning. So. My old publisher came to me and they wanted me to kind of to do a new version of my the little book of sideways markets. And I looked at it and I realized that is so not interesting to me. At this point in my life, I would not learn much. So that's not a good problem. So because that's it, because if I start working on this and it's not a good problem, just remember how we talked about Chipotle versus Starbucks, that means I'll be taking time from something else that is a good problem for me. But to answer your question, I just kind of every day, every week, I find something that interests me and I explore it. And that's how my writing comes about.
Well, thank you for doing that exploration and for writing about it and sharing your writing with us and sharing your time with me. I know you say no to a lot of things, so I really appreciate this. Thank you very much.
It's my pleasure, Brent. Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thanks for watching this episode. To help get more great guests on the show, be sure to subscribe.